Through these years, we have concerned ourselves with the study of the essence of religion and the nature and practice of meditation. This latter has, of necessity, played a much smaller part than the former, for the very simple reason that unless there is very considerable preliminary preparation, it is useless to attempt meditation in the real sense. Our study of the essence of religion has not, however, meant purely an intellectual study, just as a person might be interested in entomology and go to evening classes and learn entomology. Not in that sense at all. We have attempted, each one in his own way, serious or not so serious, to consider, to brood over what we talk about and very occasionally discuss in these meetings and live accordingly. I certainly am totally uninterested in the study of religion as an intellectualist pursuit. It's of no use whatsoever. If one doesn't intend to live religion, then leave religion in the deep sense, I mean, religion in the deep sense alone. Because religion is a power, a tremendous power, an energy. It energizes the whole of our being. That means it energizes every aspect of us. It is not a thing to play with. Unless there is the preliminary preparation, unless there is the right approach. One of the fundamental purposes of religion is the transformation of our approach to our everyday life. We approach life self-centered, self-oriented, pleasure-driven. That has to change completely from the state of worldliness. We have to change into the state of true humanity, an integral part and parcel, living consciously in cooperation with and in tune with the universal process. That is religion in its depth. And there one touches very, very profound energies and powers, because the nature of the mind is touched. It is not a case of merely physical activities or any sort of routine procedure of ordinary everyday physical life. It is a case of transforming the mind and its functioning. Whereas science, art, philosophy touch the life of a person insofar as that person's approach to the activities of man are concerned, religion transforms the not merely the one who wants to comprehend, but the comprehender himself. It is not comprehension merely that religion deals with, but you, the living being, in your totality, not in any one aspect. Therefore, never approach any religious techniques partially and in a worldly manner in order to gain something. Approach religion in order to lose everything which binds, which disfigures humanity. Approach religion in order to burn away in terms of a light as was never seen on land or sea. That is the only way to approach religion. And it is that sort of approach which we have tried to emphasize and uphold. Otherwise, much sorrow, beyond bearing sometimes, comes to the dilettante, the dabbler in religion. Now, I mention this because I want to come to another very important point now. At our last meeting, we touched upon that which marks a peak point, perhaps the very peak point, the climax of religious unfoldment, of the development of the spirit in one. Namely, the realization through the individual by transcendence of itself. And this realization necessitates the silence of the individual. Each one of us has to know what it means to be totally silent. In the profound sense, not in the common garden dictionary sense of silence as the opposite of noise, but silence in the profound sense. This is what we have to realize for ourselves. Then we cease to obstruct the energy of transcendence flowing through us as a nexus, as a focal point, quite freely. Flow into us and out of us. And this realization of silence through actual practice, through actually living the holy life, enables one to realize the true meaning of immortality in terms of our day-to-day living experience. Otherwise, immortality is a word with which we play about, always foolishly, because we form misconceptions about the nature of immortality, which misconceptions, acting upon our own minds and influencing our actions in daily life, always bring trouble and sorrow. People little realize this. That's one of the great tragedies of life. We know not what we do. If you can meditate deeply enough and ever unearth, reveal for yourself the full meaning of Jesus' words, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do," you will appreciate why one must not play with the deep truths of religion. We touched upon this matter of silence and the realization of the immortal. Let me very briefly recapitulate this, because it is of fundamental importance. I do not know of anything more important than this in the whole sphere of religion in practice, in the profoundest sense of the term. Our everyday experience and our consciousness of the world is in terms of our sense impressions, which are interpreted by the brain. Now, we are taught right from childhood, from our birth onwards, how to interpret. We are conditioned. We are taught the names of objects. And those names are words. We are taught the words which stand for actions. The doing words, as we learn in our schools, are the verbs, and the naming words are the nouns, and so forth. And the meanings and significances which are introduced into our minds in this manner are all our conditioning by others around us. Now, this conditioning of the mind is poisoned at its very root by the play of our own greeds, our lusts, our pleasure drive, our ambitions, envies, jealousies, resentments, angers, hates, also our generosity, our kindness, and all the rest of it. But every one of them is a conditioning influence. Therefore, there emerges in us, in each and every one of us, our own world view, our own conception of the world, of life, our relationship to it, and so forth. And because there are these terrible forces of greed, hate, illusion, delusion, and so forth, right at the root of our everyday existence, everything is vitiated. We remain subhuman instead of flowering out naturally and simply into true humanity. If we are true humans, then transcendent virtue manifests itself quite spontaneously, unconsciously, and easily through us. The holy ones, through the ages, in their own personal life and in their own personal being, fully manifested this transcendent virtue in operation. They were the pure ones. That's why they were the holy ones. They knew what love and wisdom and truth and beauty really meant. From them came no reaction of hate or anger or any such evil thing to any and every stimulus which daily life offered them, either externally or from within. They were also the silent ones. Now let me come to this question of the silence. Our daily life, as I said a little earlier, consists of our sense impressions, all of which receive a name, a word. So, throughout our conscious existence, even when we are asleep, except in really profound dreamless slumber, our daily life is characterized by a stream of words, either spoken aloud or silently chattered by our own brains, in our own minds. If you take the trouble to watch that chatter, you will find it is almost entirely ego-centered. Watch that chatter for even 2 minutes, and you will be appalled at the number of times the word I crops up. The isolative self-consciousness cuts us off from the wholeness and the plenitude of life, of eternal life. And that is the state of sin, the cut-off state, sundered from the unity of all existence. This I stands here by itself as against the you, the not-self, which is all the rest of the universe. Think of the extraordinary conceit and stupidity and the evil of it, the fundamental source of conflict, of duality. So you see, this stream of words just goes on inconsequentially, meaninglessly in our minds. When we concentrate our attention, as we say, in order to carry out some particular task or whatever it is, you will almost always find that in some way or other, that concentrated activity of the mind is ego-centered. It is self-centered. What do we talk about all day and every day? You can look into your own lives and see how that chatter characterizes the whole of our existence. Now, there has always been the urge in every one of us for happiness, for peace, for fruition, fulfillment. Because of our ignorance, and as indicated by the chatter which goes on, we have never seen or known the true meaning of happiness or fulfillment. We know nothing about it. So we have gone on in our everyday life pursuing ends which have no real significance. And yet this longing is there all the time within us. It is the quenchless flame right at the heart of our being. And we can never extinguish it completely because that flame is at the heart of the whole universe. And so there come times in our life when a certain quietness comes over the sense functions. And that chatter tends to calm down completely, to slow down at least. And in the slowing down, we become aware of our own existence as well as of the world around us in different terms. Now, what is this difference? Our ordinary chatter, whether it be the silent chatter or the loudly spoken chatter, is associated with the way in which our consciousness is associated with every experience we go through. There is a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending, a constant birth and death going on. This is the miserable round of births and deaths which plagues us. Leave aside all the other fantastic presentations of samsara, the round of births and deaths as they call it. They are misconceptions emerging out of the popular beliefs of primitive people. This is the real round of births and deaths. This association of our own self and our own existence with everything that arises, proceeds, and dies. I am born in that moment when I have associated the self with the particular experience or state of mind or emotion. I grow, and then when that is over, I am dead. This is the I that is born again and again. Look deeply into your Upanishads if you want to understand this properly. It's stated absolutely unequivocally. Samsara, the round of births and deaths, is nothing other than your own thought process. And if you study your Paticchasamuppada, the Buddhist causation philosophy, very, very carefully, you will find that it refers entirely to your mental process, your consciousness process, from moment to moment during your lifetime. That's what it refers to. All right. So now, we may say that we are conscious in the mode of mortality. This is perfectly true. Everything begins, proceeds, dies. That is how we are conscious of existence. We are not conscious of it in any other way, but in the way of mortality. And it is because of this mortality that we also experience deep fears, anxieties about a future, a hereafter, and so forth. Everything comes under the grasp of the Lord of Death. Death which disrupts. Death which is absolutely stark and unanswerable as regards the great mystery, the secret. The secret is the secret of immortality. That is how it seems to us. Therefore, our pain and misery. And through the ages, people have sought release from this mortality, which is the fact, in order to realize immortality. Now, when the sense functions are quiet, and the flow of discursive thought, which plagues us day and night, is stilled, becomes perfectly still, then you who are fully awake and conscious, in what manner are you conscious? Because the mode of mortality has come to an end. There is no self-association, a separate self-association with particular events, particular states of mind, which are all related to one's isolated self. Birth and death have ceased in terms of self-association in your own consciousness. Therefore, in what manner are you conscious of the totality of existence, of which you are just integral part and parcel? You are conscious now in the mode of non-mortality, in the mode of immortality. Now don't mix up, don't get muddled up here. Because of the conditioning of our mind with the definition that immortality is continuity in time and space, it isn't. As far as time and space are concerned, there is only mortality. Eternity, infinity, immortality have nothing to do with time and space. Time and space are the indispensable prerequisites for the finite, the limited, and therefore that which is born and dies, that which is mortal. So this immortality, this mode of immortality which you experience, has nothing to do with time and space, but it is a dimension of consciousness which is quite different from, because of its transcendence, the ordinary mode of consciousness that we have, the ordinary dimensions of consciousness with which we normally function. There is this new something which at last has been liberated from within. The bird of life has taken wings unto itself and flown into the uncharted spaces, immortal. That is what has happened. And it is associated fundamentally with this state of silence. The silencing of the stream of thought, not forcibly, but letting it become silent. Now, I think I'll stop here, and we'll spend a few minutes in meditation. What I want you to do, or let us all try to do, is just to be perfectly at ease and let the mind become restful, utterly poised, silent. Don't try to compel it, don't order it. Just try and let it come to rest. And see what happens during the next 2 or 3 minutes in your own mind. If you study the Buddha's discourses very carefully, in the original, not necessarily Pali, in the translations, you will find time and again the Buddha mentions the different states of consciousness which you enter upon and abide in until the final realization of the complete silence is with you. And in that state, of that state, he himself has said, you touch nirvana with your very body. Let us look at these stages. Again and again they are mentioned. You all, most of you, if not all of you, know they are called the jhanas, the four jhanas and the four samapattis. The word jhana is the Pali form for dhyana, the Sanskrit dhyana, which means attention. The mind in the state of complete collectedness, alert, awake, attending, dhyana, attention. And samapatti means coalescence, a coalescence. Now always we have these four jhanas mentioned in order, 1, 2, 3, 4. The first jhana, they say, is characterized by initial thought, by discursive thought, by, if you like, philosophic musing, paying attention to some of the deep truths of the religious life. And it is accompanied by rapture, by happiness, and a certain degree of equanimity. Then it is said that you enter the second jhana, which is devoid of initial thought and discursive thought. Now this is the really important stage. It seems to me that because it has been put in the texts in that rather prosaic, matter-of-fact manner, earnest students even have failed to realize the tremendous significance of this stopping of initial thought and discursive thought. As I've tried to explain to you, it actually means that with the stopping of the flow of words, you are free from being bound in consciousness to the whole process of mortality, beginning, proceeding, ending. The words which are the trouble. Right. Initial thought and discursive thought stops. In the next stage, what we call the state of happiness, of rapture, also stops. And in the next stage, all sorrow goes down. as it is said. Now one would have thought that by this time there couldn't be any sorrow. We know sorrow only as that which is painful to the mind, to the heart. This is what we call sorrow. There is a transcendent sorrow, the sorrow of the spirit, because you are aware of your separateness from the from transcendent reality. You will find the great poet seers of the Rig Veda talk about this in their hymns. And they question, for example, one of the sages writes, "What, O Varuna," the god Varuna, "what, O Varuna, is my sin that thou hast been angered?" Again, the words make us think in worldly moralistic terms. But this sin, this state of separation, is something in one's innermost consciousness. One is not at home perpetually and continuously with the Absolute, with the Divine, with the Totality, with Transcendence. And this is the supreme sorrow that man can know. This sorrow one must never try to be rid of. It's a mistake to try to be rid of it, because this sorrow, this pain, is the thing that moves us, gives us the dynamism to so live the religious life, the holy life, that there is the complete ending of this deadly separation between the total reality, between transcendence and oneself. It is this sorrow which goes down in that fourth jhana. And one is in the state of perfect equanimity, of perfect poise, the state in which there is no sense of a separate I-hood at all. That state in which no sense impression which is separative arises in one. The sensory perceptions could be there, could be present, but they do not disturb this state of transcendent at-one-ment with totality. All that has gone down. And the tyranny of the particular, the limited, the mortal, is out of consciousness. This is what they talk of when they talk of the fourth jhana. But now, do not think of these in terms of numbers. That is a mistake. It is not like in school, you're in class 1 this year, class 2 the next year, class 3 the third year, and so on. It's nothing like that. There is no time-space movement. The best way that I can present it is this. These four jhanas represent differing degrees of intensity of awareness of reality. Perhaps an analogy may help. Supposing a Mozart concerto means a great deal to you. You have heard it once, twice, 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times. But every time you have heard it differently, not merely because of the actual performance by the other person and the orchestra, but because you yourself were in a different state of sensitivity. It is in that way that these jhanas are different. there are different degrees of sensitivity to that total reality. You see how easily people make their mistakes. They say, now I'm going to do this, I'm going to do the other, there's all the laid down technique, and in 10 minutes I shall enter the first jhana. And then this, that and the other will happen, and then that and the other will happen, it will be second, third jhanas. But if you already prefigure in your mind what's going to happen in terms of a transcendent reality, then if I do that, I'm an awful fool. I'm deluding myself. It's all humbug then. Because the mind has this peculiar trick. Whatever you wish to see happen, if the wishing is intense enough, and the forces to prevent it are not strong enough, the impression made on your mind will be so powerful that you'll be utterly unable to disentangle the illusion from the reality. When you suddenly have an enormous sneeze, you see brilliant sparks in front of your face. There are no brilliant fiery points in front of your face. That's the actual physiological fact. They are merely the impression on the brain because of the movement of blood corpuscles across your eye. You see? And you can't disentangle them. So be careful not to interpret, or rather misinterpret, in all these ways. It is best to think of them as different degrees of intensity of awareness. The four jhanas. Now, this is a convenient way of talking in connection with oneself. But oneself is not something separate from the universe. No not self, and there is absolutely no self. Each one of us subsists by virtue of the fact that there is the environment, the totality outside. No earth, no sun, no trees, no water, there'd be no me. And that's that. So now, in terms of totality, here we come to the coalescences. I can only give you something in very brief, in a very brief way. The coalescences begin with the statement that passing, with the complete going down of all sensory impressions, with the passing away of all sorrow and rapture, both, in the state of perfect equanimity, one enters upon and abides in infinite akasha. Now this word akasha has troubled many, many people. But I'll tell you simply exactly what it means. The word akasha fundamentally means mind space. It has been translated as space. It is used in commoner garden language in India as space. It is also used as the sky. Akasha is the sky. And it is associated with the sky because the sky, unless there are clouds, appears to be shining, isn't it? It's a shining blue. Right? And the word and the root kash means to shine. Hence, akasha. See? The sky or space. But no, akasha for you and me in meditation is mind space. Now do remember that mind space is immeasurable. It is dimensionless. It has no such thing as length or breadth or depth. There are no quantities involved in it. There are degrees of intensity, perhaps. This is the realm of pure energy, that realm of pure energy out of which cosmos emerges. That is akasha. One enters upon and abides on the plane of infinite akasha, it is called, quite rightly, not finite, not measurable, therefore. What has happened? Your awareness is no longer your awareness. It is totally at one with that which permeates all existence. And remember, existence is manifestation. Existence is the appearance of the absolute. Look at the word existence itself. Ex sistere. Sistere, to stand ex, out of. To stand out of. As the manifestation, as the representative, almost the shadow of that which is the eternal absolute real, which is inconceivable. It goes clean out of the realm of conception. But you experience that. And in that experiencing, where there is complete at oneness with the totality of existence, the entire manifested universe, there can be no state of hate, of resentment, of reaction against. Because no such thing as againstness is possible where there is only the one all-pervading awareness. And the next stage, but it is not a next, remember, because that introduces the idea of time. This is associated with this, is the infinity entering upon and abiding in the infinity of vijnana, of consciousness. So now here, the differentiation between mind as mind on its own plane and absolute transcendent energy, as contrasted with energy out of which this whole manifested universe appears, and which we can measure and we can control, even as we can control the forces of electricity and heat and chemical energy and so on and so on. That energy which controls us everlastingly is completely at one in your awareness. You are at one with it. This is something to experience. And experience this, and you will know something of the meaning of omnipotence. And you will see that fundamentally this omnipotence has nothing to do with the imposition of a will or a command. This omnipotence works because of mere presence of the transcendent. Because the transcendent is present, all the rest happens. Duality doesn't emerge from transcendence itself. But an aspect of transcendence, which is brought into being by the self-limitation of transcendence, and this perhaps, and here perhaps the Kabbalah gives some of the profoundest teaching in the matter. This transcendence, by its very presence, stimulates the implicit duality within that self-limitation of transcendence and gives rise to the universal process. And when you are aware in this manner, these are dizzy heights, but try. You see, when you are aware in this manner, you clearly see the meaning of the nothing, the mystical nothing that all mysticisms have talked of. and which are almost quite beyond any possibility of word, of explanation through thought and speech. It is the no-thing state. Now, just as the jhanas really are all one in varying degrees of intensity, these coalescences, because now we are dealing with the universal, not just with oneself, this nothing, this no-thing, is the final meaning of the void which contains within itself the plenitude. And you realize the identity of the void and the plenitude. But one goes beyond this. The Buddha teaches how beyond the state of the no thing is neither perception nor non-perception. Now be very careful. We are right caught up right into in the sphere of words which are utterly meaningless to us, in a sense. But I'll give you a hint. This neither perception nor non-perception has no relationship to perception in terms of the senses, sense perceptions. When you are free of the bondage of sense perceptions, another kind of sensitivity is released in your own being. The sensitivity which just knows, as we say. The sensitivity which is related to what is called in the great religions the omniscience of God or transcendence, or in Buddhism, the omniscience of the Buddha, and so forth. It is this kind of perception. It is not the perception of a separate subject perceiving an external other object. It is perception by actually being that which is perceived. And this kind of perception becomes identical with non-perception as far as our use of words is concerned. Perception and non-perception have no differentiated meaning in that state of consciousness. And then finally, the Buddha points out that there is the complete cessation of neither perception nor non-perception. The complete cessation of all feeling and perception. In his use of the word feeling, there is a remarkably useful hint. But remember that the intellect will not grasp it. You have to experience, enter the silence. And then, if your intellect is of that order, it may be able to form a thought and word picture of it. This silence is the immortal. The end of all ill. We started by talking of this stopping of initial and discursive thought. But this is the great thing which has to be realized. And in that, all the rest emerges gradually. At first, and then, because of one's state of complete purity, a purity which is utterly incorruptible under any circumstances anywhere. It is instantaneous and it can happen any time as you please. And this is where the teaching of the East is different, say, from what St. Teresa says, that it is given only for a few moments by grace. Grace is always present, yes, but there is this which you can do through becoming utterly purified and silent. And in this is the full, complete realization of your humanity and of humanity through you.